let's start with like autistic, ADHD, neurodivergent people. A lot of us mask or have become perpetual people pleasers as a way of accommodating our social differences and a way of like, we want people to like us, so I'll be really pleasing. So the idea of doing something just for us feels wrong, feels hard. So I actually think there's also needs to be space for that. Or on the flip side, parents, if you are a parent of a disabled child, doing something just for me, what? No, there's no time for that. So I think we need to have these conversations in tension of like interdependence. And also it's okay to take the space that you need.
Welcome to Tilled Parenting, a podcast featuring interviews and conversations aimed at inspiring, informing, and supporting parents raising differently wired kids. I've done one episode just about self-care for this show. It's a solo cast from, I think, about 5 years ago, where I shared 12 strategies for creating a sustainable, doable self-care practice. I'll have a link to that in the show notes page. Today's episode is about self-care too, but the focus is on self-care for autistic people. And joining me is return guest, Dr. Megan Ananeff from Neurodivergent Insights. Megan Anna has just published a brand new book called Self-Care for Autistic People, 100 and More Ways to Recharge, De-Stress, and Unmask, which she wrote to help autistic people accept themselves, destigmatize autism, find community, and take care of physical and mental health. I really enjoyed going inside this book because, as we discuss, self-care is so much more than what it appears to be on the surface. Megan Anna considers self-care to be a collective effort that includes the well-being of the community, a framework that really resonated with me. So we talk about that, along with other ideas from Megan Anna's book, including how internalized ableism can hinder self-care, considerations for navigating self-care for individuals with PDA, and insights into co-regulation, sensory considerations, and how advocacy and accommodations in the workplace can also be forms of self-care. And if you're not familiar with Dr. Megan Ananeff, she is a neurodivergent clinical psychologist and the founder of Neurodivergent Insights, where she creates education and wellness resources for neurodivergent adults. They're also the co-host of the excellent Divergent Conversations podcast, and in addition to the book we're talking about today, the author of a forthcoming book on autistic burnout. As a late diagnosed odd ADHDer, Dr. Neff applies their lived experiences from a cross neurotype marriage and parenting neurodivergent children to their professional focus. Oh, and if you haven't listened to it yet, I highly recommend you go back and check out my other episode with Megan Anna, which was all about misdiagnoses and missed diagnoses. It's a great conversation, as is this one you're about to listen to. I hope you enjoy it. Well, hey there, Megan Anna. Welcome back to the podcast.
It's so good to be back with you. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. We talked about this book when you were last on my show. I was like, oh, we'll have to have you back for that when it comes out. So here we are, and we're going to be talking about your book, Self-Care for Autistic People. For people who haven't heard our previous conversation and maybe aren't familiar with your work beyond the formal bio, could you just take a few minutes and introduce us to your work in the world?
Yeah, I'm a autistic ADHD, sometimes OCD psychologist, and I make things. I make infographics, I write. I really am passionate about educating the world with the mental health world. I kind of have two dual passions. I'm passionate about educating the mental health world about non-stereotypical neurodivergence and things that might get misdiagnosed as other things. And I'm passionate about educating neurodivergent people about wellness resources, specifically with an eye on how do we adapt some of the things that we're taught that we're like, yeah, that doesn't work for me. And so those are kind of my dual passions when it comes to education.
I just want to, even before we move forward, encourage listeners to check out your Instagram and actually just sign up for your resources, because you send out a great newsletter. I'm on your list, and the infographics that you put together are just so helpful. And I feel like you are just sharing information in a way that I haven't seen before. And that visual representation helps me wrap my head around these messy concepts often. So such a great resource.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think in images, and it's the way I organize my own mind. And I'm really happy that it seems to resonate with a lot of people. And it's really meaningful for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. Awesome. So we're going to talk about your new book that came out, and it is called Self-Care for Autistic People. And right as we hit record, we were discussing about self-care, even just the way that that term can be problematic in some ways. So let's start there. Tell us why you were hesitant to tackle this book.
Absolutely. I love that we're starting with the complexity. Yeah, so the opportunity came to me. A publisher reached out and they wanted to write this book. And first of all, I loved it because I had just seen a book on self-care for ADHD people come out. And I was like, we need one for autistic people. But I was also like, oh, but I've never loved that term self-care. And so I had to work through that in my own process of writing this book. I'll share some of my critiques about the term and then share what I think robust, thoughtful, interdependent self-care can look like. If I were to boil it down to kind of three critiques, self-care, at least in the States, is often tied to consumerism, kind of consume this and you'll feel better. And so I have some feels about that. Yes, I realize the irony of here I'm promoting a book and critiquing self-care as consumeristic. And another area where I've had some kind of hesitancy around the term is how hyper-individualistic it can be. And I know that's a topic that comes up a lot in the neurodivergent community, is we often need to live interdependent lives. And in fact, I would suggest interdependence is a really good thing. And so some of the shallow stories around self-care can be very individualistic and miss that interdependence that I think true self-care is also care of our planet, care of each other. And then the final critique I have is this like kind of band-aid approach of you create a life where you're burning out and then you do an hour of self-care on the weekend as this idea of now I should recharge my battery. And there's often these like mechanical analogies we use and then be okay to continue to live my grinding life. I shared all these thoughts in a newsletter recently, and Sarah Wayland, author of Is This Autism, sent me a quote. I'm going to botch it, but I loved it. It's a quote from someone else. It was this idea of self-care shouldn't be about like bubble baths and chocolates. It should be about creating a life that we don't need to escape from. And I love that like robust way of thinking of self-care is about how do we be with ourselves differently? How do we be in relationship differently? How do we cultivate a life that we don't need to constantly be escaping from? I didn't articulate it that well before writing the book, but these were the things I was wrestling with when the book is designed as, I think there's like 130 different entries. I was wrestling with this. How am I thinking about self-care through a way of cultivating how a person can be with themselves differently?
It is really nuanced. From that blog post that you mentioned, and listeners, I'll have a link in the show notes page for that, I pulled out a quote. You said, I view self-care as a practice that not only focuses on our own well-being, but also includes the well-being of our community. It's a collective effort that intertwines the significance of nurturing others and our environment with the responsibility of meeting our own needs. That was just such a lovely way and such a bigger way to think about self-care. I never thought of it as something we're doing for our community. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something that Indigenous cultures have always done really well. Then when white Eurocentric people took over much of the world, we've really botched this. I've had the privilege of living in collectivistic cultures immersively. It's interesting. It's not something that you can like be like, these are the traits of a collectivistic culture and now let's embody them. It's an energy that is felt, that is experienced. There's the idea, I think it comes from the Ubuntu. Now I'm anxious that I don't have the citation on that. But it's instead of, you know, in Western philosophy, it's I think, therefore I am. And then for them, it's we are, therefore I am. And it's such a different way of thinking about existence and being and selfhood. And so if the self is always considered as existing in relation, then of course self-care is always going to happen in relation. And that fundamental philosophical difference in just how we conceptualize what it means to be a self is going to be so pervasive in how we think about everything, especially self-care, because the self is a different construct.
It is fascinating. I've started going to this yoga class recently I guess as a form of self-care, my therapist made me start going. She's like, no YouTube, you need to be in person and really restorative because I'm really trying to support my nervous system. And at the end each week, the yoga instructor, Shanaz, shout out to Shanaz, she talks about the collective energy that we're putting out and how we're supporting our community by gathering together in our practice. For me, there's something about that that really, every time she says that phrase, it makes me feel just part of something bigger. So I do love that idea. And I, again, you know, you said this right up front, it isn't necessarily how we think about self-care. We think about it as like a band-aid, or I often talk about filling our reserve tank and using those metaphors, but it's so much bigger than that. And I think that's something I'm glad that we're starting with this in the conversation as well. I just want to share what I have as a definition of self-care, and I'm wondering your thoughts on it and if you have a way that you define it in terms of what it means beyond the more philosophical definition that you just shared. Because I have a chapter about self-care in my book, Differently Wired, and I too am trying to get out in front of it. Like, listen, I'm not talking about going to the spa. Like, that's not for everybody. Most people don't have the resources, and that's not what it's about. But I describe self-care as being something that is intentional and that it's just for you. So I guess there's that individualistic piece, but I think about it as something that I'm saying I matter and I'm doing this because I know that it supports me. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and if you have a way of defining it.
I love that. So it's intentional. I really like that because it does take intentionality. So I do think self-care should be neurodependent. Let's start with like autistic, ADHD, neurodivergent people. A lot of us mask or have become perpetual people pleasers as a way of accommodating our social differences and a way of like, we want people to like us, so I'll be really pleasing. So the idea of doing something just for us feels wrong, feels hard. So I actually think there's also needs to be space for that. Or on the flip side, parents, if you are a parent of a disabled child, doing something just for me, what? No, there's no time for that. So I think we need to have these conversations in tension of like interdependence. And also it's okay to take the space that you need. For many of us, what we need is our nervous system needs some alone time. We do need something just for it so we can go back and be connected in meaningful ways to our systems we're part of. So those are my thoughts to that definition. I really like it. And I think a lot of us do need permission to do something just for us.
Awesome. I would like to talk a little bit more about how self-care differs for autistic and ADHD people. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll do that. If you listen to this show, you probably know that at least 1 in 5 children is differently wired. But did you know that approximately 1 in 2 women will experience hair thinning? If you're part of that 50%, you are absolutely not alone. But because hair thinning for women isn't something people openly talk about, going through it can feel lonely and frustrating. So why not do something about it with Nutrafol? Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. Everyone's root causes of hair thinning are different, so a one-size-fits-all approach to hair growth isn't going to cut it. Nutrafol has multiple formulas tailored to give your hair what it needs to grow throughout different stages, postpartum, menopause, even for different lifestyles like a plant-based diet. To get your personalized hair health plan based on your specific root causes, you can take a simple hair wellness quiz on Nutrafol.com. And because there's no prescription required, you can quickly get set up online with free shipping and automated deliveries, which make it so much easier to stick with your new hair care routine. See results in 3 to 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month's subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code TILT. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TILT. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code TILT. I'm on the road this month, and oh man, am I missing my sweet kitties Haskell and Lua. They've been a part of our family for more than 2 years, and I'm so grateful they're keeping Darren such good company while I'm away. If you're getting a new pet soon, you're probably already thinking about everything you'll need to buy. Food, toys, a cozy bed, doggy bags, or litter boxes. Something you may not be thinking about, though, is pet insurance. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/parenting. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/parenting. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/parenting. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Let's talk a little bit more. You just mentioned some of the considerations for autistic people, for instance, in taking self-care, who may be people pleasers, like just moving through the world differently is going to impact how they consider self-care. What other ways would a neurodivergent person experience a relationship with self-care differently than a neurotypical person?
Yeah. So, and you asked a moment ago about how I would define self-care, and I don't actually have a distinct answer yet, but one thing I do believe and say often is that self-care starts with self-attunement, the ability to attune to ourself. If I don't know moment to moment what I'm experiencing, that like, oh, right now I'm having an aversive response to this light, or this is the emotional experience I'm having right now, then I don't know what I need. And then I don't know how to care for myself. And I think this is a big piece of where self-care differs for a lot of us, or I would even say is a barrier to self-care, whether it's due to interoception differences. So that's that body awareness of what's happening inside, or alexithymia, which is difficulty identifying emotions, or masking, or people-pleasing, or dissociating from our body. We have so many barriers to that very first piece of self-attunement. And I talk about this a bit in the book, Forgive the Dualism. I, for the most part, love my mind, but my body is a very hard place to occupy. And so there's so much dissociation from it when your body is a place of too muchness, that working with that first piece, which often involves working with sensory regulation and cultivating sensory safety and nervous system safety, like these are such foundational blocks for self-care that, because as a society, we don't yet have a lens to think through sensory safety with nervous system that's catching on, this step often gets missed for us. And then if we're trying to access self-care kind of higher on the hierarchy, we're like, wait, this practice or strategy does not work for me. And we might even start to have some shame around like, why did I do these things my therapist is telling me to do and it doesn't help? And that means I'm broken because it's not working. Those are some of the ways I see it being different for us.
Yeah, you wrote, you are always worthy of love and care. Recognizing and tending to your sensory needs is one way that you can show your body and mind that affection. And when I read that, that jumped out at me for where people should start if they don't believe, right, that they're worthy of love and care, whether that's because of depression or PTSD, or we know that so many neurodivergent folks struggle with things like gender dysphoria and body dysmorphia. And so how do you encourage people to navigate that if they are starting from that place of like, I don't deserve this, I'm not worthy of this?
I mean, I think first you've got to identify that belief of I'm not worthy of self-care. Like you've got to work on that first. There's a new term, it's new to me. It's been in the psychology literature, the idea of traumatic invalidation. And how neurodivergent people experience this at very high levels for thousands of reasons we do. But even just thinking about this sensory, right? Like I remember when my child was young, that loud is noise, is noisy, right? Like that might be something she would have said. And I'm sure I hate this, but I'm sure I said at some point, it's not too loud, or I can barely hear it, or I might have. I would guess at some point I said something like that, or this hurts, or this is spicy. Oh, it's not too spicy, right? There's so much of our sensory experience even that we're having an experience and the people around us are saying, oh no, it's not too bright. It's not too loud. It's not too XYZ. So that chronic invalidation, and that was just sensory. We could talk about social, we could talk about these other things. That often has to be addressed and dealt with before getting to some of the deeper things of addressing this. I also want to say that these ideas are not my own. I have learned so much from people in my community, one of them being Sammy Asanio, who is a therapist. And she brought in this idea in one of our clinical calls about traumatic invalidation and how often before even addressing things like the PTSD, you have to really target this piece of it because it's so core to our identity. So just want to make sure and give a shout out to where this idea came from.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, I haven't heard of that concept before, but of course it makes so much sense. And I imagine that's just an experience so many neurodivergent people have from a very young age, and also perhaps in therapeutic relationships. And we'll talk about that in another conversation, because I know we are going to be talking about therapy and neurodivergence. I'm wondering, in terms of how you hope people come to your book, like, how do you hope to bring them into engaging with it and relating with it and really tapping into all the, there's so many resources in there and ideas that you're sharing?
Yeah. First of all, wherever they are in their journey of the, do I deserve this? I hope that it does have that invitation of like, you do deserve self-care. Your body deserves care. And even if you have been shamed for your needs, these are worthy. They're worthy of your attention. You deserve to take them seriously. I hope that for people. I want it to be a book that holds complexity, and I hope it helps people hold complexity of, there's so much about your autistic identity to celebrate and lean into, like your interests and your passions and your values, and that's worthy of celebrating. And also, it's okay to grieve. Like, there's hard things about being autistic, and it doesn't mean you aren't affirming or loving of yourself to grieve your limits or to name that it's hard. So I hope it's a place that people can like lean into some complexity, and then that people get to learn ways of being with themselves differently, being with themselves more gently and in a way that, again, is more attuned and is not, so many of us have just this harsh, harsh inner critic. And I think learning how to deconstruct that and find a way to be with ourselves with gentleness, I think that's really a huge hope I have for people.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to actually get into the book and learn more about how you organized it. And I want to know a little bit about your writing process and then talk about some of the themes that you explore in the book. We'll do that after a quick break. This year, I've been working on becoming more attuned to my body, and so I'm starting to really recognize how periodic spikes in anxiety or disruptions to my routines can seriously throw my whole system off. And as I've been traveling a ton this past month, which is both disruptive and somewhat stressful, I'm especially glad that I have the extra support of Symbiotic Plus, a 3-in-1 supplement from Ritual with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. Symbiotic Plus provides fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining to support a healthy gut barrier. And it comes in this very cool minty delayed release capsule, which was specifically designed to help survive the harsh conditions of the upper GI tract for delivery to the colon. The bonus is that the capsules don't need to be refrigerated, so I can easily bring them with me in my carry-on. On a personal level, I love that Ritual is committed to sustainability. They're a female-founded B Corp, meaning they are holding themselves accountable long-term to not only think about their company's financial health, but also the health of people and our planet. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide your insides. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/tilt. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/tilt for 25% off.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play, and we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. you get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
So as you were just describing how you hope people engage with it, I have pages of like notes and questions here. And the last thing that I wrote that kind of summed up my experience reading it was, your book feels like so much more than a self-care book. Not that there's anything wrong with just a book about self-care, but as an holistic person, I read your book as a guide to deeply understanding yourself and identifying, supporting, and meeting your needs so that you can experience a more self-actualized life. I think when people hear, as we talked in the beginning, hear this idea of self-care, it's like, okay, take these breaths, go for a walk, listen to the, you know, and that's not what your book is. So can you talk about how you organize the book and talk about when you were starting the writing process, how were you thinking you wanted to approach this whole concept of self-care?
First of all, I love your elevator speech in my book, and I'd love to steal that from you. It's so much better than anything I've come up with. I just ramble when I try and talk about it. So thank you for that. And that feels really kind. And I really love, you know, when you're so close to something, it's hard to know what people's experience of it. And I really love that that's your takeaway. As far as my approach, so it's self-care, and then it's broken into different kind of buckets. So like social self-care, physical, emotional, sensory, professional. And then within that, there's also even like subcategories. And that was actually something I asked the editor for. I was like, I think autistic brains need more context. Can we have like subcategories for each chapter? My approach is very educational. So I think that makes sense that you're like, oh, this actually feels like a guide to understanding yourself. For me, when I was training as a psychologist, the things that always helped me in regards to self-care or learning to be with myself differently was when I could finally grasp some sort of educational content that helped me understand what was happening. So that's always been my approach as a therapist, as a writer, is like, let me explain to you what your nervous system is doing. And I think that is actually a pretty autistic approach to self-care, is like, let me lead with the data and the information and the science, and then also say, and so what? I forget that that's an autistic approach, but I think that is woven throughout the book. And that is what makes it autistic, is how much it leans on, let me first unpack this idea and then give you an idea of something you can do because of that.
And in terms of your writing process, because it is so comprehensive, I was imagining, because I'm a writer, and so I'm always like trying to get inside the writer's brain, how did they organize this? How did, you know, I imagine that there were some themes or some sections that were very personally relevant to your experience and others not so much, maybe, I don't know. So I'm just wondering if there were any areas or strategies that maybe weren't on your radar before you started writing this book, like where your own learning came into this process.
It's interesting. I'm like laughing at this because I feel like I talk about this a bit on my podcast. The social self-care was the hardest chapter to write. One of the measurements when you get an autism assessment, that we look at social motivation, and there's debate about that word, but mine is very low. So that was the chapter that stretched me the most, in that I'm very okay with low social contact. I'm also not, I've been married for 15 years. So like, I'm not navigating dating right now. And there are some entries around dating. And I was just like, I'm really glad I'm not navigating that right now. That was the chapter where I stretched myself the most, in the sense of like everything else in the book, it feels like, yeah, I've struggled through this and I've figured out some things to work with it. So everything else felt pretty personal, but the social one was the hardest in that way, and where I leaned into my own learning quite a bit.
And how did you go about researching? What was your process like?
That's where I'm really thankful for community. I think a lot of kind of leaning in on what I've learned from the autistic community, I would say, and listening to my clients, listening to my community, listening to people of like, what are they experiencing? If they are navigating dating, if they're in a situation where they want friends and they're struggling to make friends, what are the things they're saying they need and they want? So yeah, listening, I would say, was my main strategy. and looking for themes.
Yeah. The first self-care bucket you talk about is physical self-care. So you talk about movement, some of your sub buckets, movement and regulation, sleep, and then body care and hygiene. The body care and hygiene, one of the questions that popped up, I think that people in my community would want to know, because a lot of us are raising kids who have more of a PDA profile. And sometimes that personal hygiene and that self-care can feel like a demand, especially with a younger person who may not feel motivated in the same way that an adult might. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about the relationship between maybe self-care in general and someone who is more demand avoidant.
Oh, wow. That's a big question. Okay. We need a whole podcast on that. Again, so much with PDA, reserving the autonomy. This is a huge struggle. It's something that we're navigating in our family as well. And different families will have different feelings about this. This personally is where we landed with our family and parenting, and it has worked well. So I'll just share. Yeah, I don't feel comfortable being like, this is what you should do for all PDA. I'll share what has worked for us. Being like, doing something that's good for your body is important. Here's four things you can choose from. You can do 20 minutes on the treadmill or do a walk. You can do, and then having a few, you could go to OT. You can, there's like four or five options. There is a like, okay, we need to do something here. That's important. And here's your options. Keeping the autonomy through creating options. That's been one approach. That's not going to work for every PDA child, but that has been one of our like work around the demand avoidance. And I do that with myself. I have a ton of demand avoidance. I'll be like, okay, there's this thing. We know this is good and we're going to do it. Here are your options. How do you want to like mark off this thing for today? With PDA, another thing we know is back to interdependence. That's really important, and co-regulation. So things, self-care things that are hard, especially if the parent is able to be in a regulated nervous system, body doubling some of those tasks. This also came from some wisdom of someone in my community, Claire. She's a functional medicine provider. She introduced me to the Purble. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's like a little animal that you co-regulate it, but it also helps you co-regulate. And she mentioned how that's been useful in the use of ARFID with kids. And so I think that could also, having some of those co-regulation strategies while pairing that with some of the self-care practices that are harder. But then of course, start, and this is where I go in the chapter, it is a demand. And if there's any sensory aversion to it, like that's a huge lift. So the first step is like, what are the sensory barriers? Does the kid have dyspraxia? Okay, let's do a stand-up toothpaste system. Is it the taste? Is it like, and there's a lot of new devices on the market now. So first identifying the sensory barriers and then finding some kind of co-regulation, something to pair with the activity.
Yeah. Thank you. That's great. And just so I'm clear, body doubling is that parallel playing, for lack of a better word, like doing it next to your child?
Yeah. So, and then for me, I'm like, I don't think my child would want to see me brushing my teeth, like, because that would be a sensory experience. But yeah, it's doing the same thing together. And it's something that is really helpful for ADHDers, but it's also, I think it can be helpful from a regulation standpoint.
Okay, cool. Thank you. I just want to talk about mental self-care, which is another section that you have in the book. And the first thing you talk about is addressing internalized ableism. And that jumped out at me. That's one of the things we explore a lot in my parenting community. So can you talk about why that's so important and what that might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to kind of situate it, so internalized ableism, people are perhaps more familiar with the concept of like internalized homophobia or internalized racism, but the idea of when we've taken in the beliefs about an identity we have and we've internalized it. So for internalized ableism, there's so much that we can't do until we've addressed that. Things like having boundaries with other people or setting realistic expectations for ourselves. Like anytime that we have that, like, I should be able to do this, that's internalized ableism. And actually, I see this a lot with teens and college students where it's really hard to accept the accommodation that they've qualified for. There's a few reasons for that. They might not want to stand out, which makes so much sense. But the other one is there's still a bit of internalized ableism. I shouldn't need this. And so until we've really addressed that, both in regards to, like, that's just as terrible things for our self-worth and self-identity and mental health, but also from a very pragmatic standpoint of what we're able to access, it limits us quite a bit when we haven't worked through that yet.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. And I want to touch on one other chapter and then we'll wrap up. I loved that you had a chapter on professional self-care in the workplace. There were so many powerful tips. And again, it's not something that you would think, oh, these are self-care strategies, but it's really how do you navigate being a neurodivergent person in a workplace that wasn't set up to support how you experience the world. So anything you want to share about that section that you think is really important for listeners to keep in mind?
The two that jump out at me are around self-disclosure and around documentation. So self-disclosure being, you know, I think folks don't always realize that self-disclosure doesn't have to be all or nothing, that there are partial self-disclosures. Because this question comes up a lot of, should I self-disclose both to my like HR or my employer, but also my coworkers? And so I think just thinking through the pros and the cons of self-disclosure, thinking through what are some partial self-disclosures, like, oh, I can't sit here because I have sensory sensitivities, right? That would be a partial self-disclosure. And coming up with those in advance, I think can really be helpful. And then this sounds a little bit cynical maybe, but the document, I have a like document everything in there. Especially autistic people, I just think we get misperceived, especially because of our relationship to hierarchy, as well as so many reasons. And then, you know, with the double empathy problem of like, we're both misunderstanding each other, misunderstandings do happen in the workplace. I learned this the hard way. This one did come from personal experience of like being really honest in my communication, too much so. And also realizing like systems are designed to protect themselves, and that documenting conversations, documenting if there's conflict becomes really important. It kind of is a way to protect yourself. I'm thinking a lot about protection and self-disclosure when I think about professional.
Yeah, that's great. Going back to what I said in the beginning, and I'm happy to share this little paragraph with you, and you may use it freely as you wish.
Please, I would love it.
But really, I mean, I'm sure listeners, you're getting a sense that this really is, it explores all facets of living a life and how to advocate for yourself, to show up more authentically for yourself in different spaces, and support your nervous system and all of those things. So it's just very comprehensive. And it's an adorable little book too. I'll post a picture for those of you on the show notes page so you can see it, but definitely check it out. Maybe you could close them by telling listeners where they can follow you, sign up for your newsletter, and learn more about your work.
Yeah. So Neurodivergent Insights is my brand. That's how you find me. On Instagram, neurodivergent_insights. Also on LinkedIn and Facebook. My website, neurodivergentinsights.com. And then, yes, as Debbie mentioned, my newsletter, which there's places on my website where you can sign up for that.
Awesome. Listeners, I'll have links in the show notes. And definitely, I highly encourage you to sign up for Megan Anna's newsletter. I don't get a lot of newsletters, but that is one that I look forward to receiving every week. I think it's a weekly. It's great content. And your podcast is great too. It's one that when I meet with my parent community, one of your previous episodes always comes up in conversation. So really lovely deep dives, theoretical, philosophical, thoughtful conversations. So I will stop gushing now. Congratulations on the new book. Listeners, it's Self-Care for Autistic People. As you're listening to this, it's out in the world. Definitely check that out. And thank you so much for everything you shared today and stopping by the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciated it.
You've been listening to the Tilt Parenting Podcast. To learn more about today's guest and the resources we talked about, check out the extensive show notes page on Tilt Parenting. There you'll find key takeaways, links to all the resources mentioned, and even a full transcript of our conversation. Just go to tiltparenting.com/podcast and select this episode. If you're looking for personal support from me and connection with a phenomenal community of parents raising neurodivergent kids, join us in the recently rebooted Differently Wired Club. The new Differently Wired Club can help you cultivate the positive shifts you're hoping for. Go to tiltparenting.com/club to learn more. The Tilt Parenting Podcast is hosted by me, Debbie Reber, author of Differently Wired and the founder of Tilt Parenting, and was edited by Andrea Curtis Amasquita. To support this show, please join my Patreon campaign where you can set up a small monthly contribution. Just go to patreon.com/tiltparenting to learn more. If you want to follow Tilt on social media, you can find us at Tilt Parenting on Instagram and Facebook. And lastly, please take a minute to leave a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
That helps this show stay visible so others can find it more easily. And that's all for this week. Stay safe, stay well, and take good care. And for more information about any of the parenting resources Tilt offers, visit tiltparenting.com.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.